Welcome to Truth is Stranger Than Fiction. Here's the guy who asks all the right questions. Your host, Ralph DeLugas.
Welcome to our show, everybody. You are on the Loving Liberty Network. I am your host, Ralph DeLugas. Welcome again to our weekly break from the Bread and Circus. And what circus are we being fed, huh? It's been an exciting week. I want to focus not on the impeachment nonsense, not on the politicians that are ran by the kingdom, as I like to call it, but I want to focus on some critically important articles that we have discussed, real climate threats that we can see happening that for whatever reason the UN doesn't want to talk about, but that matter. This isn't the global warming hoax, which is, of course, all about them getting power, money, and keeping control. But this is the real climate threats that regardless what your perspective and regardless of what your political preference is or whatever preference, this matters. Having food to eat matters to all of us, doesn't it? Not being freezing cold. Our children not being freezing cold. Clean water, health. These things matter to us. And this is kind of what this is all about. So I want to start with a few articles that I picked. One of them, you know, I might as well start with this. This was going to be later on, but I think this is important enough that we ought to start with it. This is from the Mighty Nature magazine. If you spend much time in any of these scientific, peer-reviewed, haughty corridors, you'll recognize the name Nature magazine. It is basically the New York Times of science. It is the pinnacle, right? And this is an article from Nature on the 5th of September, 2019, entitled Gerrymandered Minds. And I want to read you just a little bit out of this because this is important. I think this is something we all need to be aware of as we spend so much time online, social media, and so forth. And a lot of you probably already know this, but it's interesting to see if Nature magazine is worried about it, you know, we should have been really, really worried about it 5 years ago. Reading from the article, information gerrymandering can change the way we think about political decisions, such as in the cover image. People must integrate different sources of information when deciding how to vote. But information doesn't always flow freely. I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. It can be constrained by social network, distorted by zealots, automated bots, etc. In this week's issue, Alexander Stewart and his colleagues describe a game to probe the relationship between the flow and collective decision making and people on social media. In the game, players were assigned to competing parties and placed on a social network to determine whose voting intentions they could observe. The researchers showed conclusive evidence that certain network structures can sway the vote outcome towards one party, even when both parties have equal size and each player has the same influence. I want to paraphrase this because this is a lot of words, and I want to cut more to the meat of this. The important thing to remember is that the whole system is set up to keep you mad. And don't get me wrong, I'm like the worst at this. When you're full of contention and angry, like in my state, they're trying to tax. I live in a quote-unquote conservative red state where my pretend constitutional conservative elected officials talk a lot about the Constitution and family values and all this good stuff at election time, and then they put all that under their feet and worry about their friends and their pocketbooks seemingly most of the rest of the time. And as a business owner, I get mad. Some days I get really mad. And I've noticed in myself when I'm really mad, like when I hear Mitt Romney attack the president when he's done nothing to do his real duty, which is protect my rights as a citizen, my constitutional natural rights, does nothing for that. But it seems to be really worried about attacking President Trump. And we have a whole stateful. And I'll bet you wherever you're at, I bet you have a similar thing going on, whatever political party they're from. But when I'm full of contention, I've lost. It is almost as big of a thief of my focus and my energy as fear. Fear, I think, is still worse. But it's disgusting, despicable, kissing cousin. Is contention and being really angry. So I'm not saying stuff your head in the sand and pay no attention to this, but I think it's important to understand that, yes, we live in a world where all the governments have institutionalized corruption. Not just that they're corrupt, but they've made it institutionalized, deep-rooted, made it the daily business of all the governments of this world. That doesn't mean that everybody that works for government is an evil jerk, but the mechanism and the structure of government is corrupt, and that's just the world we live in. We can still be happy, and we can still go about our daily lives and not become angry. That's as much time as I want to spend on that article, probably more than I should have, but we've had some exciting I don't know if those that are new here, we talk a lot about the Earth's changing magnetic shield, and the strength is getting much weaker. The poles are shifting. Magnetic pole reversal is upon us. Solar grand minimum. These are things that are absolutely observable, that we see happening, that NASA admits is happening. They dismiss it, but it's absolutely a thing that we should be concerned about. So I want to talk a little bit about some of the articles this week from that. One of them in Idaho, I noticed, gosh darn it, where's the East Idaho records earliest ever sub-zero temps. The interesting thing about some of these temperature low temps, this is in Pocatello, Idaho. They set a new record at -6 degrees this past Wednesday on the 30th. -6 degrees, October 30th. The old record, 11 degrees. So they shattered this record by 17 degrees. That's a big deal. And it isn't just Pocatello, Idaho. The low temperature in America was actually in northern Utah, a -45 degrees in some horrible, wretched place that's really low and really cold that I'm really glad that I wasn't. But in October, this is unheard of. Low temps in San Diego, record snow across all of Colorado, across Utah. It's crazy how much we're already seeing, and this is a very important thing that we need to watch. This increased storm nucleation, increased hail nucleation, the clouds are going to become much more. Cosmic rays have an absolute predictable effect, and we are at cosmic ray maximums that we have never seen in human history as far as it's been recorded. Obviously, they didn't record cosmic rays in the 1700s or whatever, but we can see the effects of cosmic rays, and it is believed that we've not seen cosmic rays like this since the last pole reversal, which they claim now is around 13,000 years ago. So these increased cosmic rays will absolutely positively cause increased frequency of hail and the size of hail, and we're seeing it. We saw record hail again this year. 7-inch diameter hail was the record for this past year, which absolutely shatters the year before, which shattered the year before. It is getting bigger, it is getting more frequent, and it will have an effect. The volcanoes are increasing. We have another big blast from Shivalush and too many others to talk about. We see these fires, and this is another interesting thing. These fires, here's an article, California to ban the use of all ham radio repeaters unless operators pay the state's massive fees. I don't know why they're coming down on ham radio operators. This article mentions that it could be the cause of the fire. Supposedly, some more tree branches fell on some more power lines, causing these massive fires. This is so weird to me because this didn't exist 2 years ago. They've had winds forever, so I don't doubt for a minute that PG&E is neglectful in keeping its system in ship shape. I have absolutely no doubt that they're negligent in that. You know, a quasi-governmental huge corporation is only going to worry about stuff and cash in their pocket, of course, and in their the board, the shareholders' pockets. So they're probably doing a lot more of that. But I know a lot of people that work for a lot of power companies, and you know, they don't let trees be planted by power lines. And going through these transmission lines are tall. It takes a long time for a tree to grow up and over to where its branches can even fall on that. So this whole thing just smells really funny. I've heard Dutch Scent say hot spots are flaring up all over California, especially near geothermal pumping operations, which are always very, very much near volcanoes. So in his opinion, which I kind of tend to agree with, these hot spots that are flaring up out of the earth are what's causing these fires, in my opinion, again, makes a lot more sense to me. And of course, that's not something they're going to want you and I to know about or worry about. So maybe they're just PG&E is the scapegoat. Something smells really funny. I would keep an eye on this one. I want to talk really quickly. We're probably going to run up against the break, but I'll try to discuss this. We might have to go into the next segment on it. Lightning strike leaves a 15-foot hole in Fort Worth parking lot. This is amazing. This is a sign. This has never happened anywhere that I've ever heard of before. A massive lightning strike blows a massive crater in a gas station concrete parking lot of all places. And we will talk about what this means and what you can do about it after the break. Everybody, welcome back. You are on the Loving Liberty Network again. We are talking about some very interesting news articles that have come out over the past week. This one is a report on a lightning strike in the Fort Worth area in a parking lot of a gas station. First of all, how lucky are these folks? This thing's like 5 feet from the pump. There is no reason. It makes me wonder if it isn't maybe the tank in the ground. The short version here, just for those that haven't listened in a lot, we live in a plasma electric universe. Out of the center of every galaxy, we have massive Birkeland currents flowing to each and every star, which is the power by which stars shine. That shouldn't be a surprise. And stars are like giant transformers. They push out solar wind, which is a lower energy, surface of the sun, 20 billion volts. Surface in our stratosphere, 20 million, 10 million, depending on where you're at, volts. And as you go down, it drops 100 volts. At the ground where you're standing is 0 volts. 3 feet up, 100 volts. Where your nose is, assuming you're about 6 feet tall, there's 200 volts of potential there. That's a really deep topic to get into why you're not getting shocked by 200 volts just walking around in our electric atmosphere. That isn't polarized yet. That is still etheric, but that is voltage potential that's everywhere. So anyway, the Earth is a negatively charged, which I don't even like saying that. I don't believe in positive and negative. Energy flows, and where the centripetal, where it flows into, that would be what we call negative. It's all about the flow of energy. So power flows from space, or space is positive, and it flows into the Earth, which is negative, which our sweet Mother Earth turns that into, if you look at roots and how trees and the structure of just nature, it's really interesting. Trees grow along electric field lines. The roots, there's a reason when you pluck up a root and you look at it, it looks like a lightning bolt, doesn't it? That's for a good reason. So anyway, this massive lightning strike just hits the ground. No antenna, no lightning rod. And it leaves a 15-foot crater in the ground. How could that be? Never happened before. I've never seen anything like this. This is another sign of the times, folks. In my opinion, this is a plasma arc discharge. I see this all the time in my work. I'm in manufacturing. A plasma cutter can do stuff like this. High voltage plasma arc discharge. It's the only thing that can do stuff like this. It has happened before, and it is beginning to happen again. And I don't know about you guys, but I'm a little bit excited because it's going to be great. This article I had to kind of laugh at. Peer-reviewed, quote-unquote, science losing credibility as large amounts of research is often shown to be false. Now, you guys probably know most of this, and we don't need to spend a lot of time on it, but I thought it was pretty funny to see a mainstream, I think this is, I forget which article this was from, but it was Zero Hedge, I believe this is from. This is so important to know because science is just another propagandized tool, at least a lot of the science that we're taught, and we're not going to be healthy. We're not going to be free of fear if we don't know what the heck's going on. So I think it starts with understanding our world. And along those same lines, I thought this was really interesting. I don't know how many of you heard about this. A spooky Halloween asteroid flew by, one of the closest near misses ever seen. This actually is the closest near miss ever seen. And what I really find amazing is that we didn't see this thing coming. This thing came within 3,000 miles of our planet in Africa, skimmed right over Africa, and then kept on trucking. They never say how big this article is, big the asteroid is, which I thought was kind of interesting. But this asteroid passed above southern Africa within 3,852 miles. At the moment of closest approach, around 7:45 a.m. Pacific time, which is about an hour after they saw it coming, right? So to get an idea of how close this is, consider that many telecommunication satellites orbit at an altitude of 22,000 miles. This thing flew by at 3,000 miles, seven times closer than a satellite. And I do not think this was a little asteroid, or we wouldn't be reading this article about it. That's scary. So these guys are so smart, they can see in my next article. This is in science.com from NASA. Astronomers may have detected a black hole that's unlike any we've seen before. So let's pretend for a moment, boys and girls, that they've ever seen a black hole, which they have not. The only claimed sighting of a black hole is that dusty toroidal structure that they announced 6 months ago, which is obviously not a black hole. Fields, F-I-E-L-D-S, fields make structures in space. We see them everywhere. The structure around the center of a galaxy is just like the structure around the child magnet on your desk. It's a toroid. It's a donut. And when you look at it through a radio telescope, you would see a swirling toroidal centripetal centrifugal magnetic field exactly like what we see, not a black hole. There is no way that that's a gravitational. Anyway, black holes irritate me. Black holes, dark matter, Big Bang, and evolution. Those four, no proof for any of them, but yet they're taught as fact. My boys right now, we just started, they go to this little private school, and science fairs are a really big deal. This is a national chain little science or a private school, and like a third of their grade in science is the science project. And I'm reading through, and just because you get your kid in some private school, don't think they're taught good science. It's the same garbage, maybe just minus the gender confusion or whatever else. But they're still teaching these kids that water crystals in the atmosphere rubbing together create static electricity to make lightning. Like NASA hasn't even been saying that for 20 years. That comes from space, through the red sprites, through observable things that we can see that make total sense. It comes from electricity. You don't rub water, snow crystals together and make static sparks, and certainly not the massive. You don't blow 15-foot craters with static sparks from water crystals. Anyway, sorry for going on that tangent, but black holes are a pet peeve of mine. They've never seen one. They never will, because they're made-up nonsense. That I can say I know, because that's just a fact. Anyway, I want to talk a little bit about our main topic this week. I want to talk about American ancient history. We've talked before about giants. You know, the main guy I want to talk to, we'll get to after the break. But I want to talk about, where are we at now? Mesa Prieta petroglyphs. This is in the, New Mexico, maybe southern Colorado. It's an archaic petroglyphs, and archaic is about, 3,000 BC to 1500 BC, roughly, in Mesa Prieta, northern New Mexico. Super interesting. There's in this canyon called the Chacoan, I'm going to butcher the name. Anyway, this canyon, and they call these Anasazi Indians, there's this huge city, and they've discovered all these roads. These roads are perfectly straight. They are built in a symmetry that we could not match today. They're perfectly, They're perfect symmetric circles going out from the central city in Chaco Canyon, and they're everywhere. And they've also determined there's these towers every so often. They say they're religious bonfire towers that lit these roads. I'm really skeptical of that, too. These guys, to make roads like that, you don't do it with just a bunch of rocks and your mallet, right? But anyway, we're going to come up against the break. We're going to talk in great detail about this. Some of you that might be of the same faith as me, you will recognize the people that we're going to speak of. They're called the Jaredites. And the proof of these folks, the mound builders up in northern in North America, Canada, Great Lakes area, and from there they spread out everywhere. And the evidence of their cities are from sea to sea. This was many, many millions of people. And giants, we're going to talk about giants again and all that coming up after the break. Okay, everybody, we're not quite done. By the way, this is the Loving Liberty Network. You are on Truth is Stranger Than Fiction, the show that we talk about things that matter, not made up nonsense, and we focus on science. Today, we're going to talk a little bit about ancient North American history, the stuff that you're not going to learn about in school, but that is more true, in my opinion, than pretty much everything. You know, this drives me nuts. I was talking a little bit before the break about my kids, and I've made a huge financial sacrifice to keep them in private school, and we've decided to no longer do that after this year because, you know what, I don't love really that much more what they're learning there. They're in human history, they are learning about how men evolved from apes, and it's taught as history, how they eventually started communicating, and finally they started using tools and developed a language. It's like, this is nonsense. Language popped up magically after some giant flood in six different civilizations spread across the globe overnight. This all just happened overnight, and they all had language, and their characters all look almost exactly the same up until another event about 2400 BC, which happens to correspond with something that happened at the Tower of Babel. Maybe some of you have heard of that, where some language got a little gobbledygooked up, right? My opinion, the best history book we have is the Bible, the Old Testament, the Torah, and some of these writings, which is just frankly hidden. It's just not taught. Even though this is real proof and things like evolution, there has never been any proof of human evolution, and there never will be. If that were true, you wouldn't be able to throw a rock in any direction, dig a hole anywhere on Earth, and not find some sort of proof. But we never find any proof of anything evolving out of anything. Not a mouse that evolved into a bat, not a tree that evolved from a weed into a tree, or anything like that. We don't see evolution in process anywhere. And don't let them tell you that adapting to your environment is proof of evolution. It is not. I can't choose to grow wings because I want to fly across a canyon. Just isn't going to happen. Anyway, so I want to talk about ancient American civilization. Most of the facts I'm going to give you today are from a guy named Wayne May. He's a 30-year archaeologist. He mostly in the Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, Iowa, Midwest to northern Midwest, Great Lakes, southern Canada area. These are the territories where most of the mounds and mound builders were found. And, you know, the interesting is when the pilgrims got here back, you know, late 1700s, early 1700s, even early 1800s, this was common knowledge. They would move into an area. The farmer would start plowing, and he would dig up giant skeletal bones, these armor plates, giant breastplates that are copper and for some reason are still perfectly sound. These people had we'll talk a little bit about the copper in a minute, but these guys had great technology, and they were big dudes. They were 8, 9, 10, 12 feet tall. We'll talk about some of the dimensions. That's actually something we'll also talk about probably in the last break. But so anyway, this guy, Wayne May, he had been doing research for 20 years, and he came across a book that some of you may have heard of before. This is a book called The Book of Mormon. translated from an ancient record that was also found in America. And this record was about a group of people that in this book are called the Jaredites. And what I want to talk about just for a moment is some of the archaeological proof that these Jaredites were here. And according to this guy, and his evidence is compelling, and we're not going to have time to talk about every little detail, but according to him, there is a mountain of evidence suggesting that they are descendants of Ham, from the lineage of Ham. So that's kind of interesting, too. So these are big guys. How big were they? Let's actually change gears really quick, because I want to just rapid fire at you some of the accounts from another good source that I love to read from, a man named Jonathan Gray. And I won't read you every source for every one of these, but I think it's important to know just this isn't just one or two kooky people that found a great big finger bone somewhere, and from that we decided that men used to be big. No, this is overwhelming evidence. So North Carolina in 1874 remains of an 8 foot 9 inch tall man. This is from Brad Steger. In Indiana, a 9 foot tall giant in copper armor found in 1925 by Frank Edwards. In Wisconsin, skeletal remains of humans in a giant mound up to 11 and a half feet tall. Western Missouri, skeletal remains of head bones of monstrous size, lower jawbone twice the size of a modern man today. Thigh bone looked like that of a horse. For size, found in mounds, 1875. Pennsylvania, human skeletons 9 feet in length. Florida, 10 foot tall skeletons in the sand of an island off southern Florida, found in 1936. Interesting, all these dates are pretty old. For some reason, we don't find them anymore, even though they absolutely do find them. I have a friend whose daughter worked in New Mexico in the forest. She was going to school, and she was an intern for the Forest Department. She worked on a dig where they unearthed these giant skeletal remains, and they were whisked off to the Smithsonian Institute, and not a peep was ever said. When they were found, for some reason, the CIA came in and set up a perimeter. I don't know why this is an area of national security, but for some reason, that falls under their jurisdiction. And she reports that every day she was searched, every day leaving she was searched, no phones, no pictures, nothing like that allowed. And all that I can say is that I know this woman to be truthful. I know her father, and I think it's a truthful account. And I think for whatever reason, we're not told about this. Nevada, a giant leg from a knee that knee to heel, 39 inches, indicating a man of about 11 to 12 feet in height, found in 1887. I'm just going to try to pick a few. Texas, a human footprint 21 inches long, walking with a stride of 7 feet under a waterfall, found in 1913. Colorado Desert, Montana, Oregon, human footprints 19 inches long. This is everywhere. Minnesota, California. Let me see if I missed any area of the country. I think that pretty much covers it. There was a whole platoon found in Oregon. I call it a platoon. I want to say it was like 24 men, all in battle armor, copper armor. Swords were of incredibly good quality because they hadn't cankered away. They weren't disintegrated, but the armor was in perfect shape, which is something that we can't explain, a process that's been lost today. But these guys were 11, 12 feet tall, 4 or 5 feet wide, a huge wingspan. I forget the numbers. I don't have it in front of me. But anyway, this is a fact. So why are we not told this? Well, you guys can make up your own mind. But back to our story of the Jaredites. Let me call that back up. So this is from the period and from the people that we know of in archaeology called the Edina and the Hopi. I want to say Hopi. I might have that wrong. But their timeline is in 2300 BC. And according to modern archaeology, these people disappeared somewhere around 400 to 600 BC. Massive cities in these giant mounds. And the evidence might seem a little bit thin on some of this, but I think what basically happened here, we had a civilization that came in, actually multiple civilizations from Israel. We know that a lot of people came a lot earlier than Columbus, and these civilizations rose and they fell like civilizations do. But a lot of the new structures were built on top of the old structures, kind of like the megalithic structure in Rome that the Romans built upon, that everybody thought Rome did, when it's clearly far older than them. I think these Jaredites had incredible technology, and you want to talk about there's been 10,000 mines now found up in the Michigan, Wisconsin. That whole belt is one of the richest copper deposits in the world. And these guys had 10,000 mines. How good as smelters were there? Well, when they came here, if you those that have heard know the whole story, which we don't have time to get into today, but this amazing guy knew a way to smelt to molten out of rock 16 stones, which they used to light their boats. Now, how do you melt a rock? How do you melt silica quartz into a clear crystal stone? Well, the first thing you need to do is have 3,000 degrees in your furnace. Now, I don't know if you've ever tried to blow a fire with animal skin bellows to 3,000 degrees, but you're going to pump yourself stupid and you're still not going to get there, right? A plasma arc has to be a vacuum arc. This is the sort of thing I work in all the time. Today, we would have no way to do that other than to create a plasma arc furnace or a vacuum arc remelt furnace using electricity. We can't burn anything and get to that temperature. So how did this guy do it out in the sticks using who knows what, right? Well, let's talk about that a little bit after the break and a little bit more about these great people, where they went and what they were about. We'll talk to you soon. Okay, everybody, welcome back. We are talking about ancient American civilizations, one in particular, what I like to call the Jaredites. This is a civilization that came to America about 2300 BC. These guys were great workers in iron, and according to Dr. May, they were descendants of Ham, and we'll try to squeeze some of that in as to why he believes that. Some records that were found in Missouri, partially interpreted and translated, says that these guys came through the Egyptians, came through a righteous pharaoh, one of the originals, Egyptus, son of Egyptus. But we'll talk about that in a minute. But before they came here, this guy, I believe his name was Mahanrai Moriankumer or something like that, he had a problem. He made these amazing boats, and they were going to sail and go to a new land, but they needed some light. And he had this great idea of he prayed about it and was inspired to make 16 clear stones. A lot of people, of which I am one, believe some of these stones eventually were made use of in a device called the Urim and Thummim. But that's probably something we don't have time to talk about today. But how do you melt rocks into clear stones? Well, these guys had technology. There is absolutely no way. They didn't have some alien technology. The Anunnaki weren't there doing it over his shoulder. This guy just had technology. And I think that's one of the things that is completely lost on us today. These weren't hunter-gatherers that unga-bunga'd around and clubbed their wives on the head, and eventually they became super smart people like the guys that are lying to us today in science. No, these guys could do things that we still can't do. We can't make a copper breastplate and have it be in perfect shape, perfectly sound, 4,000, 3,000 years later. Ain't gonna happen. It would be, I have copper out in my shop, copper airlines that are crap after 5 years. So yeah, these guys had technology. We don't know. There are so many things. We've talked about that a little bit before, but these copper mines are everywhere. Up to like 9,800 of them are cataloged. Mining site copper, 2400 BC in Michigan, in Siskiyou site, in Lookout Point site. I mean, these things they're everywhere. These guys were massive. It's kind of interesting. If they are descendants from Ham, we know who did Ham and Tubal Khan come from. Well, they eventually – they're descendants of Cain, who was the first smelter. He was the first guy to melt gold. He was also the first world banker. Kind of an interesting thing there, but that's a side note. These people started out as a bunch of really good guys and eventually fell into some kind of dark ways. Secret combinations brought them down. Kind of reminds me of some other civilizations I know about, like, I don't know, the one I'm sitting in. But they found massive waterways. And the interesting thing about this is these waterways that are clearly made by human beings, there is no way. We're talking 2000 BC, right? There is no way that, human beings used picks and axes. And according to mainstream science, these guys didn't even really have hardened steel picks and axes and whatever. These guys were cutting waterways to float the metal to the mining process, if you know much about it. They're finding pyramids that these guys built, the mounds, of course, we know about, the tools that these guys made, and their size. These were big people, and I don't know if they were all big or just some of them were big. It seems over time that man, when he was first on Earth, because we know that Adam was pretty good sized, and a lot of these antediluvian people, not only did they live longer, they were a lot bigger. I would say they were a lot smarter, because they developed technology far in excess of ours. And maybe that's why it's not talked about. We can't have people thinking that man was ever smarter than we are today. And it certainly conflicts massively with the made up lie of evolution. So maybe that's why it's not talked about. I don't know. But let's go over a little more of some of this Dr. May's evidence. Let's skip that. These mound builders of Michigan, who were they? Well, interestingly, as descendants of Ham, these would have been of African-American descent. And if you look at a lot of the pictures in, for some reason, they only let us see the South American ones, but so many of these statues that have come out of the mounds in Michigan and throughout the Ohio Basin and West Virginia, Kentucky, all over the place. They have features that look like modern day African Americans, except for they were much, much bigger. So was the brother of Jared, Mohanrei Moriankumer, and all those that descended from him, were they black? Well, the case is pretty compelling that they were. They certainly liked making statues of black people, and I don't know where they would have gotten that knowledge from if they weren't looking at themselves in the mirror and their neighbors. Let's talk about the Kinderhook Mound found in Pike County, Illinois. This was found in 1843. A man who was still alive at that time, living nearby, named Joseph Smith, was pretty good at translating ancient documents, especially from this era. So these they found some in this Kinderhook, Pike County, Illinois. There were some plates of ore found, and this article doesn't say what kind of ore, but they ended up in Joseph Smith's hands. It was known that he could interpret things, so they gave him a crack at it, and he did interpret them. And let me just tell you, and by the way, these plates were found with skeletons in the same structure that were 9 and 10 feet in size. So let's see what, oh darn it, let's see what Joseph Smith had to say about what he interpreted. And these were only partially interpreted, so we don't know. Let me try to find it. We don't know exactly everything about them. And I apologize, I'm having a hard time finding that quote, but I really liked it. Joseph Smith said, what I want to tell you is that this land was called the Land of Desolation, where this was found. And this man, Onondagus, was a king, and he was a good man. He was a, oh, where is it? Basically, I'm going to have to paraphrase because I don't want to get lost in my notes here. But he was, Joseph Smith says, according to these writings, that he was a descendant of Ham, that he lived 1800 BC in a land which Joseph Smith called the Land of Desolation, which we know to be, let me find, according to Joseph Smith, that Land of Desolation was, it was outside north of Illinois, north of Nauvoo, Nauvoo is a land that they called Zarahemla. And let me skip to the end of this. Okay, these, just for reference, the Edina civilization was Ontario, Michigan, down through Missouri, Illinois, that whole region there that we know it, a later civilization of Nephites and the Lamanites, also known to be in that area. And it is my opinion that many of these cities given credit to them, the Hopewells, that's the civilization. The Hopewell civilization is who most scientists credit this to, these structures and these mounds and so forth, but it doesn't add up. They came later along. So anyway, we're going to run out of time. I didn't get to quite talk about everything I'd like to here. But the point is, basically from sea to sea, we see proof, in my mind again, that these things that we call scriptures, these things that are given us as light and truth, like the Bible, the Book of Mormon, and just good men like Jonathan Gray, there's truth all around us. And what does it point to? Well, in my opinion, it points us up. When I look at these great civilizations and why they fell, I look at my civilization and what's going on around me. And yeah, I'm a little discouraged that my local legislature seems pretty determined to steal every last penny that we make. And all around us, we have, I seen an article on Ron Paul a couple days ago that Trump is going to give another almost $1 billion to further militarize these armed legislation enforcement. I think I heard that on your show, Brian. Legislation enforcement officers that we have all around us, because like they need some more tanks to run around it. Anyway, the point is this can make us mad. But the key is to not get mad. Don't have fear. We have great times ahead, but be prepared, okay? We've got crustal shift. We've got an earth that's going to get a lot colder. And we've got hearts of men that are going to get a lot colder. So have a good next upcoming week. I'm glad we got a chance to talk about some things that are not of the bread and circus. If you get a chance, if you want to know some more about this sort of stuff, Jonathan Gray is a great source. He's one of the few good guys we have left that's a lifelong archaeologist that talks about some of the ancient civilizations, which is just incredibly fascinating, the things that these ancients did, antediluvian and so forth. But take heart, because these times will be back upon us, and all will be well, and you have yourselves a good week. Don't forget to say a prayer in the morning and be nice to your neighbors throughout the day, even if they vote for Hillary Clinton or anyone else like that, okay? You guys have a good week. We'll talk to you soon.